This section of Jeremiah is a section that kind of gives me chills as I read that. I joked with some last night about this passage, and especially starting at the beginning of it in verse 20 and 21, that those are verses that we're not going to slap on a coffee mug. That's not what you're going to see somebody packing around to their coffee shop. Now hear this, O foolish and senseless people. But it might be the verses that we need the most. These are verses that cause us to get our attention. They cause us to stop. They cause us to think. And as we draw to the end of that passage, again, this question is posed to us. What will you do at the end of it? As I said, it gives me chills. I want to talk this morning from the book of Mark. We're going to be digging into that and examining a statement that Jesus makes, causing or instructing those around him to watch out, to beware. And we're going to be looking at a lot in this chapter this morning. There's quite a bit that we're going to cover in Mark 8. But I want us to see the emphasis of the chapter maybe is not where we've put it in the past. I'm very thankful for the songs that Brother Roger led for us this morning, songs that have highlighted different aspects of Christ, that have talked about his priesthood, that have talked about his glory, and songs that cause me to wonder myself, do we know who Jesus is? We're going to ask that question again here in a moment. Do we know who Jesus is? I want you to be thinking about that as we get into the lesson. But I want us to remember how we got here, how we got to Mark chapter 8, because there's a lot that has transpired to bring us to this point. And one of the reasons why I enjoy studying and I enjoy preaching in the way that I do, and going through these lessons, chapter and even verses at a time, is because it forces us to stay in the context of what's being said. Mark chapter 8, especially verses 1 through 10, is so easy to pull out of its context and to see the miraculous things that are done. See the amazing things that God is able to do and lose the point. Lose why it was done. What is being taught? What is being conveyed through these miracles? Miracles are not just an opportunity for God to flex his muscles. It's not just an opportunity for him to show how amazing he is. He is teaching. He is confirming. He is trying to get our attention through these things that we read about. We need to understand that. We need to see what's happening here. Up to this point, we found Jesus in a region that is not known for having a large Jewish presence. If you'll remember, back in chapter 7, he's confronted by the Jews over the hand washing, and his disciples not doing it as they left the marketplace, as they began to eat. And so by kind of in extension to that, they're asking him, why don't you teach your disciples to follow these traditions? This is very much a question for him, an accusation against him. And so he leaves that region and goes into this place where you're not going to expect to find a lot of Jews. You expect to find a lot of Gentiles. And as he was there, as he's been in this region, he's done things like casting out demons. In fact, he's done that before. We talked about last week about how maybe the fact that everybody's bringing, you know, people are coming to him, people are asking him to do things for their family, is because this man that he cast the demons, Legion, out of, back in Mark chapter 6, maybe those people that he went and talked to have said, hey, I remember this guy. I listened to how he changed this guy's life. I listened to what the miraculous things that he's done for him, and I want him to bless me that way. I know that I've got problems that I can bring to him. Maybe he can help me with the things that I can't solve. But something exciting is about to happen in the book of Mark. Something exciting is coming up, and it's on the horizon, and we're not going to get to it today. But Mark chapter 8 houses the first time in a 16-chapter book, the very first time that Jesus' true identity is going to be confessed. Now, we understand that it is in the introduction. It is introduced to us as the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So we understand that from an outsider's perspective. But for people walking with Christ, after everything that Mark has discussed with us thus far, we're getting ready to get to the point where the first time somebody is going to verbally announce Jesus is the Christ. That's going to be revealed. This huge event is on the horizon, but following it up is going to be things that cause us to step back and go, maybe we don't understand what that means. And so while all that is getting ready to happen, the things that lead up to it should really get our attention. The things that lead up to that confession of Peter later on in Mark 8 are vitally important to painting the picture of the identity of Christ, causing us again to step back and go, who is this Jesus? Even those closest to him are still struggling with it. So if you want to begin reading with me, Mark chapter 8 and verse 1, and we're just going to read through the first 10 verses together and look at this miraculous event, the feeding of the 4,000. In those days, when there was again a large crowd, they had nothing to eat. Jesus called his disciples and said to them, I feel compassion for the people, because they have remained with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way, and some of them have come from a great distance. And his disciples answered him, where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to satisfy these people? And he was asking them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. And he directed the people, sit down on the ground. And taking 7 loaves, he gave thanks and broke them and started giving them to his disciples to serve them. And they served them to the people. They also had a few small fish. And after he had blessed them, he ordered those to be served as well. And they ate and were satisfied. And they picked up 7 large baskets full of what was left over of the broken pieces. About 4,000 were there, and he sent them away. And immediately he entered the boat with his disciples and came to the district of Dalmanutha. Do you feel like we've been here before? When you read this, does this just not sound eerily similar? Like, this has just happened, has it not? And we've already experienced this miracle. Why are we seeing this again? In fact, in my Bible, I literally turn back one page, and I'm at Mark 6, verse 33. I'm at the feeding of the 5,000. So why do we have these two events that are so similar recorded in such close proximity? What are we supposed to learn from this? Well, one thing that I want us to learn is there are some things that seem similar to Mark 6, but there are some very big differences in these sections. Some of the most important ones are ones that we've already noted. Jesus is in a heavily Gentile region. Chapter 8 starts off in those days, in the days of what was occurring in chapter 7. Things that he is experiencing in this region of the Decapolis, in this region of Gentile proximity. In those days, Jesus performs this miracle. So that means we're still dealing with a largely majority Gentile crowd. I'm sure there were Jews that were there. I'm sure there are Jews in this region. But as we talked about last week, this relationship of this very heavily Greek-populated city, it's kind of like oil and water to the Jews. We're not very far removed from the times of the Maccabean Revolt. We're not very far removed from the times where the despisement of the Jews and the pagan ways of the Greeks have caused them to have this conflict that brought a very bloody and messy war. They don't get along exceptionally well. And so, while it is very likely that there are Jews there, the majority is going to be this Gentile, very likely Greek population. And when we get to this point, we also see another difference in these accounts, and that is the response of the disciples when Jesus says, we need to provide food. We're going to feed this crowd. In chapter 6, they balked at that. Chapter 6, they saw, like, where are we going to, or how are we going to afford to do this? If you remember chapter 6, they said, well, it'd take 200 denarii to try and buy enough food for the people. So it's a possibility, but it's going to cost us a lot. There's a lot that's going to have to be sacrificed to get enough food to feed all these people. That's not what they say here. They balk at the possibility of this, but they ask a very different question. The question they ask specifically is where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in this desolate place to satisfy these people? And I think those words and the words that they used are very important for us to pay attention to. Let's start towards the end of that statement and work our way back. And I want to say that some of these things are just opinions that I have, things that I've pondered over as I've studied through this. And so I want to leave them in that realm. But there are things that I think are worthy to mention, because I think we can see some human nature coming through in the disciples of Jesus. For starters, they seem to designate this group differently than they did the people that they were dealing with in chapter 6. They say, where are we going to get food for these people? Now, in our culture today, we can't say things like that about people that are not like us. We risk being canceled very quickly if we are going to start throwing around descriptive terms of people based on their race, based on their look. And to refer to someone as these people refers to them as somebody different than us. I'm not sure that that really changes as we go back in cultures. This people is designating them as different than me. Where are we going to find enough food to satisfy these people? Right off the bat, it seems like they see a difference between the crowd that is here versus the crowd that is there in Mark 6. But I want to note, it's not just that there's a difference. It's a difference that I'm not sure anyone can satisfy. These people are different than me because these people have an appetite that's different than mine. And that's not probably leaning on the fact that they were different than them body makeup wise. It's probably not that these guys just are big people that eat a lot, but rather it's probably leaning on the fact that they're pagans. They're pagans who have given in to their lustful desires. They're pagans that serve all of these different gods that focus on the desires of the flesh. In the eyes of the Jews, these people have a lifestyle that is devoted to being unsatisfied, to filling the senses with whatever it is that you deem pleasurable. And so they ask the question, how will we ever find enough to satisfy these people? And again, these are partly opinions that I hold on this, but it does seem that might be part of the mindset behind his disciples, the people that are following him. They are viewing themselves in sort of a sense of moral superiority, if you will. We're the people that follow Jesus. These people aren't even Jews. These people are people that follow pagan gods. And yes, they're coming to him now and they're asking him questions, but we all know, just like he told that woman a few verses ago, he's here for the Israel. He's not here for them. Because why? Because we're the covenant people of God. They're not. Where on earth, Jesus, are we going to find enough food to satisfy people like this? But even with all of that being said, it's actually the very beginning of that sentence that causes the most confusion. It causes the most, you know, picture of just someone scratching their head going, what kind of question is that? Because the question they ask is certainly seems to be directed towards these people, seems to be directed towards the manners and the type and the belief, the things about these people that make them the way they are. They say, we just can't understand where we're going to get enough food for that. But it's not where are we going to get it, like it was in chapter 6. You know, we have to buy, you know, 200 denarii for us to go buy food. Here it's, can anyone satisfy these people? Can anyone do something to provide enough that will satisfy people like this? That is the question that they are asking. Now I want you to consider that what they have seen is 5,000 people fed with 5 loaves and 2 small fish. Here they have 4,000 people with 7 loaves and a few small fish, arguably, they have less people, more food, and the one thing that remains the same in all of this, the great God of all creation standing in their midst, and they have the audacity to say, how is this going to happen? Is this even possible? What kind of question is that? But it really brings back to our question at the beginning. Do you know who you are following? Do you know who Jesus is? This question marks the very real difference between these two accounts. Their eyes are so focused, maybe on themselves, maybe on the type of people that they believe themselves to be, or maybe on the people around them and the type of people that they believe them to be. They're not focused at all on God. They're not focused at all on what He can provide. Is there someone in the crowd that can satisfy these people? Yes. There's one who has demonstrated His ability to do amazing and unbelievable things, including feeding a great crowd. And it causes me to wonder, have they learned nothing? Have they not gained anything from the time that they have spent following the Messiah? Their question regarding, can anyone feel the needs of a group of people like this? I hope it details to us that there are some very stark contrasts between these two accounts. There's some very stark contrast between what's happening in Mark 6 and what's happening in Mark 8. But I hope it also causes us, as we look through this, to say, but there are some things that are similar. You know, like the fact that Jesus performs a miraculous event, like He feeds a lot of people with a little bit of food, like He is able to take that blessing and convert it into something that He gives out and brings back even more than He gave out. But I think the real similarity is actually the fact that Jesus has compassion on both of them. In Mark chapter 6, Jesus doesn't have compassion on them because they are superior, more superior than the crowd here. In Jewish minds, they're not. This crowd is not more superior. He has compassion on them because they're lost. He has compassion on them because He looks at them and sees them as sheep without a shepherd. His compassion because He looks at them and sees this people, this crowd, is so scattered, is so lost, that even something like food, like a basic nourishment, needs to be provided for them, and I'm the guy to do it. I'm the one that's going to do that for them. Jesus has compassion on that crowd. Here, He looks at this Gentile people, a people that by all accounts to the Jewish mind, do not come close to the same level of caliber of people as the Jews. And what did it say? Jesus calls the disciples together, and what He stresses to them is, I have compassion on these people too. I have compassion. I feel compassion for the people. We're talking about very different crowds. We're talking about a very same God. God that sees them the same, the God that has a desire to fill them the same. And I hope we're also putting together here that then the emphasis is probably not on the food and probably not on the bread and the fish and more so on the God and the people who are coming to Him. People who come to Jesus, people who come to be filled by Him. They have come and said, please, help my daughter who is possessed by a demon. They have brought people to Him that cannot see and cannot hear and cannot speak. People that need assistance that only He can provide. They're coming to Him and saying, I need what only You can offer. And Jesus is repeatedly showing that He is the one that fills those who hunger and thirst for Him. Who hunger and thirst for the things that only He can provide. Jesus is feeding the spiritually starved. As we move on, as amazing as this is, as amazing as those first 10 verses are, truly fascinating events are unfolding before our eyes. And again, I want us to stress as we read through this, verses 1 through 10 is not the focus of Mark chapter 8. We need to remember that. So let's keep reading together and look at verses 11 through 13. This is a period of time where Jesus once again comes back into contact with the Jews. We remember he's came to the district of Dalmanutha, and in verse 11, the Pharisees came out and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And sighing deeply, sighing deeply in his spirit, he said, "Why does this generation seek for a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." Leaving them, he again embarked and went away to the other side. So once again, he comes into contact with the Jews. He's been in contact with the Gentiles, and what we've seen him find is a persistent faith, is a faith that looks to him to solve things that man cannot solve. Man has proven not to be able to do anything about. A faith that even when tested, doesn't turn away, doesn't give up, but continues to mine out and search out the blessing that can only come from God. And then he comes back into this relationship with the Jews. He comes back to people of the Jews, covenant people of God. And what does he find? He finds people that are arguing with him, people that are testing him, people that are again seeking to try and prove that he is not the solver of their problems. He is not the one that you can bring things to that nobody else, no man can solve. Only God can fix. So we've got to test that. We've got to argue against that. This is the relationship that he seems to come back into. And if you remember last week, we read from Isaiah 35. And what did we notice in that chapter? What did we notice in a very short chapter filled with imagery about the coming of God? What we noticed was it was going to be marked by many things. One, it was described as him coming with vengeance, coming with retribution, but also coming with salvation. The Jewish view of judgment is not as simple as our view of judgment. When we think of judgment, we think simply of punishment. When God comes to judge, it is him coming to vanquish his enemies. In the Jewish mindset, and the way that judgment is used throughout the scripture, it is a very complex issue of God, yes, bringing his wrath, but also bringing his grace. When the God of judgment shows up, he shows up to protect and to preserve and to glorify those belonging to him and to make war against his enemies. It is a very complex picture that entails both retribution and salvation. And when the God of judgment comes, Isaiah 35 tells us that it will be marked as a picture of the passing away of sorrow, the passing away of sighing, and being replaced with joy and praise, specifically by those who are made to see, those who were made to hear, those who are made to leap, and those who are made to shout, the blind, the mute, the lame, all being changed by the coming of God. And we noticed in that section, as we looked through chapter 7, that when Jesus came and he entered into this region, he sighs before he calls to this guy, or calls up into the sky and says, "Be open." And the muteness, the deafness, it disappears. This picture of sighing is going away and it's being replaced with joy and with praise. It's also being replaced with wrath and with retribution. It's being replaced with judgment, with the joys of judgment, the glory of God for those that belong to him, those that have come to him to be filled, and those who stand against him, those who argue and test and fight against his presence. And so it's no surprise to me here. As the Pharisees come and they argue and they test him, what does Jesus do? He sighs. Again, we see a prophetic picture being played out in front of us. He sighs and he says, "There is no more signs that is going to be given to you." And an interesting picture is being painted. These people, how many signs have they been given? I mean, a plethora. You just spend all day digging through the Gospels to see the abundant amount of signs that not only have been done, but those that could not be done by, anyone else. They, in their own acknowledgments, have said, how can someone do this if God be not with them? A lot of signs have been given. So when we stand back and we look at these people, what do we see? We see a people that are not satisfied. We see a people that are given enough, and yet their hunger and their lust for more is not filled. Very much so, we see the people that the disciples were talking about whenever they said, where are we going to find enough to satisfy these people? Jesus is looking at they're talking about the Gentiles. Jesus is looking at the Jews, and he's seeing the very same thing. How much more could be given? Where would the line ever be drawn? Where would you ever be satisfied? Jesus sighs and says, no more. Enough has been given. So we think back to our class in the Hebrew study. On Wednesday night, a comment was made about faith being the evidence. And we need to know why we believe what we believe. I need to be able and ready to give an answer to someone who says, why do you have hope? Why are you different than everybody else whenever the circumstances point to life is just miserable and uncomfortable and hard and it only ends in death? Why are you different? Because I have hope in something different. The lesson of what we've been studying in Hebrews is I have hope in a greater country, a greater home, a greater life. There is something far supreme to what we're experiencing here. We need to be ready to give an answer to that, and that includes meaning I need to be ready to give evidence for why I believe Jesus is the Son of God, why I believe the resurrection is real, why that has changed my life. But the evidence is hope. That was the comment that was made. And truth be told, while we need to know those things, we need to be ready. We can only give so much. We don't have 100% scientific proof to show this is God. Here he is. You can hold him. You can touch him. I can explain him. An explainable God is not a God. He is bigger. He is more glorious than the task of being able to explain him can allow us to do. So what do? We take the evidence that has been given to us and we learn it and we relish in it. Jesus himself in John chapter 1 is described as that evidence. He explains him. We take what we have been given and we learn from that and we hold on to it. But at some point we take a step of faith and say, I have been given an abundant detail. Details that have proven to me beyond a doubt in my mind that these things are true. And while I don't have 100% evidence, I've got enough that says I'm going to change everything about my life to follow this and believe this wholeheartedly. That evidence was given to the Jews. It was given to the Pharisees. And it was never enough. And we're going to find people in our lives today that it's just never enough. I always need a little bit more. A little bit more. If I just had this, if I just had that. And if we are waiting around for that, if we're waiting around to just have one more thing, if God would just do this to show me, if there was just one more piece of evidence to put this together, we're never going to be able to put that puzzle. We're never going to be able to construct that puzzle together fully. Because all of the pieces haven't been provided. Enough of the pieces have been provided that I can see clearly what the picture is. The final piece of the puzzle is my faith that puts that together and says, I don't know, I haven't seen with my own eyes the end of the promise. This one part of the puzzle. But I know it's there. I know it's real. Why do I know? Because I've got everything else that points to it. Everything else that surrounds it in vivid detail, 100% confirmed, 100% shown reliable. I have everything I need, and I'm asked to let God fill in that last piece in judgment. The problem is sometimes what we do is we want to take Jesus and we don't want to treat him as the fulfiller of the puzzle. We don't want to treat him as the one that in time, in judgment, is going to make it all perfectly clear. We want to treat him as more of an idol, a talisman that says, look, I follow you as long as you're doing good things for me. This is very much the sense that we get of the Pharisees here. They say, just show me again. Why don't you be the circus act that will perform for what I require? And we'll just keep turning the crank on this monkey until it doesn't do what we want it to do. And then that way we have proved it wrong. We have proved that it is not what it claims to be. It is nothing more than a show. We need to be very careful that we don't do the same thing and turn Jesus into an idol. He's not a performer for us. He's not here. He didn't come to this earth to just look at all of our wants and our wishes and make all of those things come true. We've seen countless times throughout Scripture that Jesus in a relationship with God oftentimes goes against the things that we may want and we may desire and calls for us to transcend that, to make our wants and desires His and to see things the way that He sees them. And so we can't approach Jesus that way and we can't approach the church in that way either. We have a very, real tendency to view God and His church with a consumeristic mindset. What I mean by that is, whenever I go down 27, there are places that I go, I'm not eating there. And it's not because Sam has said, don't eat there. It's because I had an experience there, I didn't like it. They didn't meet the things that I deemed important. They didn't serve me the way I wanted to be served. They didn't fix my food the way I wanted to be fixed. And so as a consumer, I look at them and go, that's not for me. You can keep doing what you want to do, but we're not going to walk together because I'm not going in this restaurant anymore. I'm going to go somewhere else. Sometimes we have that same mindset when we come to God, when we come to His church. If it doesn't meet the things that I deem as important, if I've got my checklist of things, I want this, 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 and this. If it doesn't meet what I want, I'll just go somewhere else. I'll just do something else. I'll just believe something else. We must make sure that we don't allow the blessing of being a consumer in America, we don't allow the privilege that we have in that to bleed over into our spiritual lives to say, I'm the one that's shopping here. We've been bought. We're not doing the purchasing. We've been purchased. We've been redeemed. We need to recognize Christ for who He is. We get stuck in our worldly cares. And when we do that, we become hard-hearted. Hard-hearted is a picture that describes the followers of Christ throughout the last several chapters of Mark. And see, what happens is we start thinking on physical levels, but God thinks on spiritual ones. Reminded again and again of Isaiah 55, His ways are not my ways. We see things in terms of relationships. We see things in terms of family. We see things in terms of finance. And God sees souls. And God sees hearts. We need to think on His level. And to do so, we need to treat Jesus as more than just the performer of amazing things. This generation has been shown so much to see who Jesus was, and yet they are blind. In Mark chapter 4, Jesus said in verse 12, while seeing, they may not see and not perceive. While hearing, they may not hear and not understand, so that they will not turn to God and find forgiveness. Why was it they weren't going to turn to God and find forgiveness? Because they didn't understand who Jesus was. They refused to understand who Jesus was. While so much evidence was given to them, enough that even the most unintelligent of men around them could look at this and say, this is the Lamb of God. He's here. I'm going to follow Him. I'm going to give up everything and follow Him. Enough signs had been given. But Jesus, just like the prophets, rightly spoke of these people. They were hard-hearted. They would refuse to see, Jesus for who He is. But what about those following Him? What about His disciples? When we read on just a little bit more, we're going to do verses 14 through 21. I want to suggest that we're getting to the main event in what we're looking at today. This is the main picture that you need to draw back from in Mark 8 and go, what is happening here? So verse 14 says, they'd forgotten to take bread. You remember, they got back in a boat, they're going to the other side of the sea. They had forgotten to take bread and did not have more than one loaf in the boat with them. And he was giving orders to them saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not see or understand? Do you have hardened hearts? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000? How many basketfuls of broken pieces you picked up? They said to him, 12. When I broke the seven for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up? They said to him, 7. And he said to them, do you not yet understand? Beware of the leaven. This is Jesus's big and main point. I would argue this is the reason everything has happened up to this point. All the things that were done, the feeding of the 4,000, the going to the Pharisees, all of this to bring a point to the forefront of the eyes of the minds of those that were walking with him each and every day. Watch out. You're in danger. You need to beware. And the question that he asks them, a series of questions. Do you see? Do you understand? He's asking you. He's asking me. He's asking people who are following him. Not pagans. Not people that are off living their lives that are devoted to them, and not to the Pharisees, those that are claiming to follow God, but are proving over and over again that we don't have a clue what's going on here. We are blind to all this. The people who have seen Jesus, have seen the miracles, have said, my life needs to change to follow this guy. He says, do you know who I am? Do you see? Do you understand who Jesus is? And if you're here today going, yes, he is the Christ, the Son of God. Let's say, Peter, hold on. Because Peter thinks he gets it too. Peter's going to be reminded very quickly how little he truly understands about the identity of Christ. Because in the future, the theme of this book, upon being revealed, is not, I am the Son of God with a lust for power. I am the Son of God who has came to promote this exclusivity in those that come to me over and over again. It's going to be a picture of, I am the Christ that suffers. And I am the Christ that is humiliated. And I am the Christ that dies. Not so that the Jews could become redeemed. So that all the nations of the world could come to God. No matter what they do, no matter what their background is, no matter how despicable anyone might see them, I am the Christ that will die for them. And he paints this picture by bringing up Herod and bringing up the Pharisees. And he warns his disciples, don't have the leaven of them. And again, as I said at the beginning, I hope by this point we're realizing something that maybe the disciples are having a hard time seeing. This isn't about the bread. Get the bread out of your mind. What are we talking about? When he describes the leaven, he's describing the heart, the thinking, the actions. He's warning his disciples, don't be like these people. Well, what were these people like? When it came to the identity of Jesus, who did Herod think that he was? Herod thought that he was the one guy who had kind of stepped into his life, made him miserable, told him, you can't have the wife that you have. He thought he was the resurrected John the Baptist. Herod is a guy focused on power, focused on placement and position. It is about who I am and where I am. And he is a guy renowned for being an unfair judge. What about the Pharisees? What did the Pharisees link him to? In chapter 3, verse 20, and in verse 30, they linked him to the power of Satan. Just in chapter 7, they linked him to impurity. Over and over again, he is not what we picture as moral perfection, as righteous holiness. He's not like us, the covenant people of God. What did these people desire? They desired power. And they desired control. And they desired a self-formed view of glory. They viewed themselves as part of an exclusive group. No one else can be a part of us. No one else is as righteous as we are. And even after these amazing miracles that Jesus performed, he goes to those that are truly following him and he says, be careful. You could be like them too. Are you like them? I want you to consider the last time that Jesus fed a great multitude. The scene that followed was the disciples in a boat on the water. Same exact thing is happening now. He's fed the 4,000. Now his disciples are in a boat on a water. And what is he chastising them, or admonishing them, I should say, about? He's admonishing them about their faith. The very same thing that happened in chapter 6 whenever he came walking on the water. And then filled with fear, he asked them, why are you of so little faith? Again, here, on the water, following this great miracle of feeding the masses, Jesus confronts them about their lack of understanding. Underlying both of these events is the issue of Jesus' identity. An issue that later on, as I said in chapter 8, he will confront head on. But here he confronts it by asking these four questions. Do you not see? Do you not hear? Do you not remember? Do you not understand? And he couples that with the statement in verse 18. And that statement in verse 18 most likely points back to Jeremiah 5, the passage that was read for us at the beginning of this lesson. The passage that asked the question, do you not know who I am? And do you not fear me? I have placed the boundaries of the sea. The sea is in submission to me. Now, we've seen that. We've seen Jesus do that. He says, I am the one that provides the rain for the harvest. I am the one that provides your bread. We've seen that too. All of these things being fulfilled in Christ. The question is, do you not get it? Do you not see and do you not hear? Or are you like the evil men of Jeremiah 5? The Pharisees, Herod, they fully developed the picture of these evil, wicked men. Jeremiah 5, verse 20, 26 and 28 talks about them, but it continues on. In chapter 6, verses 17 through 28 talks about those who get rich off of and make themselves fat off of the goods of others. We have seen that time and time again with the Pharisees. In chapter 7, he talks about those who do not judge with justice. We've seen that with Herod. He says, beware of the leaven of these people. Don't be like the evil, wicked men who did not see and did not hear and did not understand and did not fear the God of heaven. Don't have hearts like these. And what separated? What separated the disciples, those that are following him, what separated them from these men? Because it's very clear in this passage, they've got some of that. They view the people in the beginning of chapter 8 as different than them. And they're not viewing God through Jesus as someone who can solve these problems. There's some things that they aren't getting. They don't understand. And even after it is revealed later on in Mark, we're going to see time and time and time again that they still don't get it. So why does Jesus not just sigh and say, this generation too doesn't get any more signs? You don't get it. The answer is simple, but yet is one of the greatest undertakings that man has done. They followed him. They didn't get it. But when he said, come follow me, they laid everything aside and they followed him. And then they go and see things that are amazing. And they prove, they open their mouths up and prove, we're still men. We still don't get it. We're not going back to that former life. We're here with you. Each step of the way, I'm continuing to follow you. And even though they have a hard time seeing it, they see some of it. It's being made more and more clear as they go along. But as they walk with him, as they follow him, their hearts are being molded. I think that's a picture that's going to come up in our next lesson very vividly with the man who is healed of his blindness. It takes Jesus two tries. And it is not because the first one he messed up on. He didn't get the mixture right. He didn't mess up something in the ingredients. There's lessons for us to learn. Why are these disciples different? Because even though they don't get it, they're committed to finally getting it. They're not like the Pharisees going, nobody can be like me. Now they're going to show them that mindset even again later. They're going to talk about, hey, we saw guys that are doing things, and it looks like they're doing things that we're doing, but they're not walking with us. They're not like us. They're going to demonstrate in other places. They still don't get it, but they are committed to following Jesus. And that brings us back to his identity. Why was it they're committed to following him? Because they recognized something about him. Even though they didn't fully understand what that means, they didn't fully understand how that plays out in their lives, they recognized that God alone is the provider. He is the one that gives rain, and he's the one that gets harvest. God alone is the one that places creation under his submission. And they remembered that when people lost sight of that, when their people lost sight of that, when they tried to provide for themselves, when they tried to force others to submit to them, whenever they tried to be the ones to say, I'm going to be the one that dictates what is holy and what is not holy, what is good and what is evil, when we lost sight of that, we careened headlong into judgment. Jesus' warning to them is that is still possible today. That is still a threat that my people face if they refuse to see. And so in these passages, while the identity of Jesus is being more and more fleshed out and shown to us, the identity of us is being fleshed out as well. Am I like the Pharisees? Am I like Herod? Am I like one that is self-seeking, that is looking after my righteousness, my holiness, my power, my position? Or am I like his disciples? Do I see, do I demonstrate over and over again that I don't fully understand? Am I spiritually dull? That seems to be the picture of the disciples. They were spiritually minded, but they were dull at times. Which one of these do I fit into? If I am waiting for Jesus to do something to get my attention, if I am waiting for another sign, for that extra piece of evidence, I'm waiting for just one more part of this puzzle. If you just give me one more thing, then I'll believe. If you'll do this for me, then I'll believe. I'm going to be waiting into eternity. The signs have been given. The evidence is there. What are we going to do with that? More likely, we've seen Jesus. We've given up a lot to follow him. But over time, we demonstrate how little we understand, how much we still need to grow. The questions are for us. Do we see? Do we hear? Do we remember? Do we understand? In just a moment, after we take up the invitation, we're going to remember the Lord's death. We're going to partake of the Lord's Supper. It's a perfect opportunity in that. Every week, for us to ask these questions to ourselves. For us to remind ourselves who Jesus is. Yes, he is the Christ. He is the Son of God. He alone is the one that provides for us. He is alone the one that brings the world into his submission. Have I been living a very consumeristic life? Have I been living a life that shows that, yes, I get it, that Jesus is God and that he has died for me, but I still live for myself and I still live for my position. I still live for my power. I still live as if I view myself as the one that somehow attains to this righteousness through the actions and the things that I commit. As we partake of the Lord's Supper this morning, I hope that it will cause us to think back to just who Christ is, what He has done. And if we can assist you with that, don't wait until that moment. Come forward right now and learn how Christ fills those who come to Him. Talk about that together as we stand and sing.